Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Russell Banks, who reads from and discusses his new book, The Reserve, published by HarperCollins. In the weeks to come, we have Carlene Bryce, Rick Steves, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover, it is my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for supporting independent bookselling. We are delighted to welcome one of America's most esteemed novelists back to the Tattered Cover to present his new book, The Reserve. Russell Banks, who, to quote the Village Voice, quote, has now become the most important living white male American on the official literary map, a writer we, as readers and writers, can actually learn from, whose books help and urge us to change, unquote. And with his new book, once again, readers are exposed to depths and truths about our society. The LA Times calls The Reserve a, quote, riveting narrative featuring an almost pot-boiling love story set against a backdrop of global unrest and clearly demarcated class tensions. In his own words, Russell has said, quote, the characters are glamorous and romantic and in some ways doomed, which has not been the case with my previous work. The doomed part, probably, but not glamorous and romantic. The author of 20 books, Russell Banks, a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters, has received numerous literary prizes and awards, including a Guggenheim Fellowship, National Endowment for the Arts, an O. Henry Prize, and Best American Short Story Awards. Two of his novels, Affliction and The Sweet Hereafter, have been made into films. Also, I was curious to learn that Russell is involved in a movie adaptation of Kerouac's On the Road. Russell is a founding president of Cities of Refuge North America, an organization that helps writers persecuted and silenced in their native countries find safe haven in North America, spaces where they may practice their craft freely. He has taught at a number of universities, including Princeton. Currently, he's a New York State author. We are so honored to have him back with us here tonight. Please give a warm welcome to Russell Banks.
Thanks. It's a great pleasure to be here again. And this is a wonderful and beautiful story. That quote from the Village Voice has followed me around a while, and it makes me feel like a shelf in a bookstore, you know, white male authors or something like that. But I'm not complaining about it. And this book is, in many ways, in some ways, a departure from previous books, and so the question which often comes up when you're talking about your work or you're presenting your work and so forth, the question, where do you get your ideas, it applies really to this book in some ways, I suppose, because I don't get my ideas for this book from maybe my usual sources, or at least I didn't get all of them. And it's not quite, where the hell do you get your ideas? But there is a little of that. And the main thing is that the question makes me slightly uncomfortable because I don't really know the answer, but yet I feel compelled to try to answer it. And I especially don't know the answer when the book has only recently been published, which is the case here, which it's only a week or so out. Because the truth is, it's really 10, 20, and I now know 30 years after finishing a novel or a particular short story that I could come up with a reasonably accurate answer, an honest answer to the question. And this is because there are inevitably and inescapably many, many different origins for a novel. Anyone who writes one knows that, and it's very hard to identify one or two or even three out of it. And it takes time, usually a very long time, to separate them out and name them. And with this book, The Reserve, I've just begun the process. But even so, a few months ago, my editor, Daniel Halpern at HarperCollins, asked me to write a few pages of notes about the origins of The Reserve that they wanted, HarperCollins wanted to tip into the back of the galleys, the bound galleys that they send out to booksellers and reviewers. And I know that it was coercive. They were trying to control and navigate, manipulate, I should say, the reviewers, more than the booksellers, into writing reviews of a certain type. But I knew nonetheless that by the time the book was actually published, those end notes that I wrote would be out of date, and they would be inaccurate, and they would be misleading, and they would be certainly incomplete. But I wrote them anyway. And I'm here now to begin the defense and the correction and the rebuttal of those notes. And I'll probably be doing it for the next 20 or 30 years. But to begin with the personal, because there is a personal source, I suppose, for the novel. And it is true, as I said in those galley notes, in that in recent years, I had gradually come to realize that the spending habits and restrictions and the associated fears and anxieties that had been forced upon my parents in the 1930s by the Great Depression, because they were working people in a small town in New England, were actually mine as well in the 21st century, despite the huge differences in our respective economic conditions, my parents and mine. But they'd been passed down to me from my parents' youth, like their DNA. I'm speaking about small things in a way, but which were observed and ridiculed by my children, like shutting off the lights every time I leave a room, turning the thermostat always down, making sure that all the doors are closed and so forth, and preserving this small bit of oil in the furnace. Walking long distances to drop a letter in the mailbox instead of driving there, that sort of thing. My kids made fun of me for it, but I knew that it came from the 1930s somehow, and it came from my parents' life long before I was born. So I thought I might somehow get to the ground of my own economic fears and anxieties if I imaginatively explored theirs. So the novel, as I first conceived it, was to be a visit to the working-class world of my parents long before I was born, a trip to the Great Depression in small-town America, driven by a desire not so much to better understand my parents as to better understand myself. But once I started researching and then writing about my parents' world, I realized I was equally fascinated by the world of those Americans whose lives weren't especially threatened by the Great Depression. The old patrician New England and Manhattan families who lived off inherited fortunes amassed decades earlier by their parents and grandparents in the so-called Gilded Age. You know, these were the children and grandchildren of the robber barons and industrialists who had cordoned off vast tracts of the Adirondack wilderness for their great camps and private preserves. And all through the Depression, and even to today, these two classes live side by side in an intricately interdependent relationship in which one group, the local struggling poor, my parents' group, was a servant class, and the other, the summer resident grandee, was a ruling class. Now, my wife's family happens to descend from the latter group, the ruling class. And over the years, almost against my will, and in defiance of my left-leaning politics and my working-class background and sympathies, I'd learned slowly, gradually, with great resistance, that her forebears deserved my sympathetic understanding as much as the impoverished local people they had hired as guides and housekeepers and cooks and caretakers. I had learned that the rich are people, too. It was hard, but I learned it. They're perhaps not quite the same as you and I, for reasons that you may recall Hemingway famously explained to Fitzgerald. You know that story, I'm sure, where Fitzgerald says to Hemingway, the rich are different from us. And Hemingway says, yeah, they have more money. But what he was also saying is, but yeah, they're human beings too. And that's the side of this little account that's never really pointed to. And that was what, in a way, Hemingway got and Fitzgerald didn't get. But despite the fact that they have more money and power than the rest, they still, as Hemingway knew, have hearts that swell and break over love and loss, and minds that collapse with grief and dreams of a better world for all, and guilt and bitter disappointment at not being able to establish that world. The point I'm trying to make, however, is that this came to me not before I wrote the novel, and I didn't make a little list of things I wanted to write about, but while I wrote it, and strictly as a result of writing it. And if a critic or reviewer or the general reader, as the rest of us are called, notices certain similarities between the reserve in a particular novel by a dead author, Hemingway's 1936 Seldom Read, To Have and To Have Not, for instance. How many of you have actually read, I mean, be honest, have actually read To Have and To Have Not? One, two, three. That's about standard. It is seldom read. But it's not because I set out in the beginning to rewrite the master's least accomplished work. It's because as I wrote The Reserve, I began to hear certain echoes and rhymes linking that book's Depression-era themes with my own. And so I went back and reread To Have and To Have Not, and I saw that it was, in many ways, Hemingway's somewhat ham-handed response to the criticism that he was getting in the mid-1930s from his leftist colleagues like John Dos Passos and Sherwood Anderson and Edmund Wilson for having up to then avoided in his work the cataclysmic effects of the Depression on the lives of ordinary people. Which then led me to ponder that perennial conflict that's faced by successful left-leaning artists in this country, from Hemingway then to Tony Kushner now, or E.L. Doctorow, or Russell Banks. But it's an ongoing conflict for those kinds of artists whose best audience and support and their social milieu all come from the very class their politics attack. And more to the point, I recognize Hemingway's personal conflict as an artist in a capitalist society in crisis, and I identified with it. And I folded it into one of the four central characters in the novel, who's an artist who's based loosely on the painter and illustrator Rockwell Kent, who was a radical leftist, and in the 1930s and 1940s, one of the most admired and successful artists in America. Now, originally, I'd based my character on Kent, but I love his work, and I collect it if I can, because he lived and worked most of his life in the Adirondacks, just down the road from my home there, where the novel was set, and because, also, I have to confess, of his reckless, philandering sex life, which is always a lot of fun to write about, and more so than politics, certainly. But anyhow, it's through the process of writing the novel, and this is the same point I was making earlier, and reading a Depression-era novel that it seemed vaguely to recognize, that I was invited to give to my Kent-based character a moral conflict, a political conflict, that Kent himself probably never dreamed of or suffered from. And then there are these certain dimly remembered historical events that lurk behind the book, like the Hindenburg, which was financed by the Nazi Party and so famously exploded in New Jersey on May 7th, 1937. And when I say the word Hindenburg, I bet you almost all have the same image of it exploding. You don't have an image of it flying. You have an image of it exploding. Now, that entered my novel because my researcher, a woman named Nancy Wilson, who works with me, I asked her to go out and check the local newspapers for the summer of 1936 to see if there was like a forest fire or a bank robbery or a murder or something that I would need to know about if I was putting my novel in the summer of 1936. And she came back with this item about the Hindenburg having been sighted flying south over the Adirondack Wilderness, which is this pristine wilderness in the northeastern corner of New York State, and down Lake Champlain, this great 125-mile-long lake, down Lake Champlain on its way to New Jersey. And for me, and I suspect for almost any novelist, this is an irresistible image, and especially with those big swastikas on the tail fins. And so that when it entered the novel, I couldn't leave it out. So did the rising shadow of fascism, the historical context for these characters, the world context. But in a way, so did the collapsing shadow of the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001. And I say that because a reason you all can imagine, when I say the word Hindenburg, the explosion, it's because it was the first disaster that was broadcast live. In Chicago, there was a radio reporter sent to Lakehurst, New Jersey, who broadcast it live. And I'll bet you some people here in this room know the last words of that hysterical crying, which is, "Oh, the humanity." And by Saturday that week, everyone in America had seen pictures of it exploding because they got their visual news and Pathé news on Saturday at the movie theater, and they didn't get news at 11. They got news on Saturday, and but it's because it was so everybody thought it happened in a way to them, and it lives even though only 33 people were killed in the explosion of the Hindenburg. And then because my art is based on Rockwell Kent, was the pilot of a 1932 Waco biplane, which was introduced mainly so I could describe this pristine wilderness and the lives of these people from above, as it were. I was led, while describing his flying skills and exploits, to imagine him as one of those leftist Americans who had joined the Lincoln Brigade in 1937 and fought in the Spanish Civil War. So that took me there. Some of those men were pilots and barnstormers who had learned to fly combat missions in World War I in Europe. They were brave, and they were romantic, and they were idealistic men, which is something I wanted for my character, who fought and who died for a noble cause. But in that way, I was able to find for my character a resolution, albeit a tragic resolution, to his personal, political, and artistic conflict. So I could go on telling, I suppose, where the ideas for the novel come from, but I hope my larger point is made, which is that the ideas that mattered to me most, and I hope to the reader, came out of the process of writing itself. And this is true also for the plot, so-called, and for the themes and for the images, and for much of the locale, and for the characters themselves. One thing suggested another, and then another, and then another, and I merely tried to keep up all the way to the end. And that's really why one writes fiction, after all. You do it in order to think thoughts, and see things, and hear things, and most importantly, to feel things that you'd otherwise be unable to think, or see, or hear, or feel. And in the end, it's also why we read fiction. So that all said, I'll read you a little fiction and then take some questions. And I'm just going to read you a few pages just to give you a clue to where it's set, how it's set, and who a couple of the characters are. This is a difficult novel to read from because the pieces are locked together and there are a lot of pieces. And there aren't what often happens, at least in my novels, there are sometimes set pieces that have a beginning, middle, and end within the novel. This is a little different. So I'll start at the very beginning, and then I'll read about four pages, and I'll jump to a little bit later in that same sequence and read about two pages. When finally no one was watching her anymore, the beautiful young woman extracted herself from her parents and their friends and left the living room. She passed through the screen porch and crossed the deck and barefoot walked softly over the pine needles in front of the sprawling log building downhill toward the sheared ledges along the edge of the lake. She knew that shortly the others would notice, not that Vanessa had left her father's party, but that the light in the room had suddenly faded, and though it was still late afternoon and not yet dusk, they would see that the sun, because of the looming proximity of the great range, was about to slip behind the mountains. The second Tamarack Lake was deep and long and narrow, like a Norwegian fjord, scraped by glaciers out of the north and south running great range of steep granitic mountains. And the view from the eastern shore of the second lake at this hour at high summer was famous. Most of the group would take their freshened drinks in hand, and following Vanessa would stroll from the living room down to the shore to watch the brassy edges of the clouds turn to molten gold, and then, turning their backs to the sky and lake, to compliment the way the pine and spruce woods on the slopes behind the camp shifted in the dwindling alpenglow from blue-green to rose and from rose to lavender, as if merely observing the phenomenon helped cause it. After a few moments, when the alpenglow had faded, they would turn again and gaze at the lake and admire in silence the smooth surface of the water shimmering in metallic light reflected off the burnished clouds. And then at last they would notice Vanessa Cole standing alone on one of the tipped ledges that slipped into the water just beyond the gravelly beach. With her long, narrow back to her parents and their friends, her fingertips raised and barely touching the sides of her slender, pale, uplifted throat, Vanessa, gazing in dark and lonely Nordic thoughtfulness into the whole vast enclosed space between lake and forest and mountain and sky, would seem to be situated at the exact center of the wilderness, its very locus, the only meaningful point of it. For her parents and their friends, for an interesting moment, the drama of the disappearing sun would be Vanessa Cole's. It was nearly silent there by the shore, low waves washing the rocks at Vanessa's feet, a soft wind sifting the tall pines behind her, and she could hear her thoughts clearly, for they were cold and came to her in words and sentences rather than feelings, as if she were silently reciting a list or a recipe she had memorized years ago. She was not happy, Vanessa told herself, not one bit, and she wished that she had stayed in Manhattan. It was always the same here, year after year, her mother and father's annual 4th of July show, and though it was more her father's show than her mother's, that didn't make it any better. Not for her. Everyone had a show, she believed, and this was not hers, not any more, if it ever had been, when she heard in the distance a low humming sound, a light intermittent drone that rose and fell, surged and lapsed back almost into silence, and then returned and grew louder. She realized that it was an airplane. She had never before heard or seen an airplane at the Second Lake. Rangeview was the largest of only a half dozen rough-hewn log camps, a few of which were elaborately luxurious, located in the 40,000-acre privately owned wilderness, the Tamarack Wilderness Reserve. Vanessa's grandfather Cole had been one of the original shareholders. When shareholders in the reserve, members they were called, or their invited guests, flew up from Boston or New York City in a private airplane, which they sometimes did, as it was a long, arduous day trip on the Delaware and Hudson train to Westport and by automobile from there, they came up the Hudson Valley and flew in from Lake Champlain north of the mountain called Goliath. They landed their airplane in a broad mowed pasture over in the village of Tunbridge, 3 miles west, where they were met by a car sent from the reserve clubhouse, so that an internal combustion engine was never heard, nor an airplane seen inside or above the reserve itself, or even above the Tamarack clubhouse and golf course. The mountains and forests and the lakes and streams were held for the exclusive use and enjoyment of members and their guests, most of whom, at least those who did not have their own camp on the Second Lake, stayed at the grand hotel-like clubhouse and the cottages that surrounded it. The mountains and forests and lakes and streams were off limits to strangers, tourists, and the inhabitants of the several hamlets in the region, except, of course, for the local people lucky enough to be employed by the members at their camps or at the associated clubhouse, cottages, and golf course as servants, caretakers, cooks, caddies, and guides. They were allowed onto the reserve and club grounds, but only to work and not to fish or hunt or hike on their own. Now Vanessa could hear the airplane clearly and steadily. Though she could not see it, she knew it was coming in from the north, flying low, tracing the Tamarack River to the first lake and on to its headwaters here at the second. Suddenly the airplane appeared in the northern sky, just above a line of black silhouetted spruce trees. It was rising in the distance over the water quickly, its gleaming belly exposed to the waning sun, as if the pilot had decided to take in the view of the entire lake and surrounding mountains and the darkening sky, when she heard the engine cut back. The airplane, a pale gray biplane with scarlet trim and two open cockpits, a goggled, hatless pilot in the forward cockpit, the other empty, slowed there, seeming almost to pause in flight and hover when it banked to the west, headed toward the mountain wall that plunged straight into the glittering water. It was a seaplane with two large pontoons, and she thought she was watching a man about to crash his airplane deliberately against the 1,000-foot vertical slab of gray granite. And she forgot her cold thoughts and grew almost excited, for she had never seen anyone kill himself and realized that in some small way she'd always wanted to and was surprised by it. The pilot seemed about to smash the airplane against the rock face of the mountain when less than 100 yards from it he banked hard to the left, dipped the wings back to horizontal, cut the engine speed nearly to stopping, and swiftly descended toward the water. The airplane touched down at the far side of the lake, broke the surface, and slid into the water, unfolding high fans of silver spray behind the pontoons. Vanessa was relieved, of course, but felt a flicker of disappointment, too. Her parents and their friends stood smiling on the near shore in front of the camp. They clapped their hands appreciatively and gazed across in a welcoming way at the pilot of the airplane. Near them, 4 Adirondack guideboats had been drawn up onto the bank and turned over to dry. Vanessa's mother sat gracefully on one hull, her barefoot legs crossed at the ankles, and sipped champagne from a crystal flute. From her distance, Vanessa admired her mother's gentle, slightly dreamy poise, and decided that it was the dress, a cream-colored, low-necked, beltless frock by Muriel King that hung straight from the shoulders. Her mother was in her early 50s, too old to look that good, Vanessa thought. It was the stylish designer dress and the simple gold bracelet, she decided, and the bare feet. The other women and the men, though they would no doubt dress more or less formally for dinner tonight, wore what they thought were Northwood's hunting and fishing apparel, wool slacks, checked flannel shirts, rubber-soled boots, rugged Abercrombie and Fitch camp wear. Vanessa herself had on a pale blue sleeveless cotton blouse and a white pleated skirt that pointed nicely to her long tanned legs and narrow feet. She wasn't so much competitive with her mother's appearance as wanting to distinguish it from hers. Just as her mother, even if she had to wear dresses from Greta Garbo's personal designer here at camp and go barefoot, seemed to want to distinguish her appearance from that of the other women, who were her oldest, dearest friends. More than either of them thought, however, or wanted to think, Vanessa Cole and her mother were alike. And I'll just jump to a little later in the scene. After this visit by the pilot, who is the artist Jordan Groves, at the invitation of Dr. Cole, Vanessa's father, to see some paintings and perhaps to sell some of his own to the doctor, who is a collector. Jordan thanked the doctor for his hospitality and nodded to the group and quickly departed from the room. The sun had disappeared entirely behind the Great Range, and the lake was black, and the temperature was dropping fast. Outside on the deck, he stopped to roll and light a cigarette and check the wind. In the west, above the sooty mountains, the sky had faded from lemon to silken gray. The air was still smooth, he noted. The blue-black eastern sky was clear with swatches of stars already visible, and over the treetops behind the camp a half-moon was rising. The pilot smoked his cigarette and made his way in the gathering darkness down the path to the lake and walked along the shore to his anchored airplane. She was waiting for him when he got there. She stood barefoot on the rocky beach in her white skirt and linen jacket, looking eager and elegant and brave. Jordan said nothing to the woman, and she said nothing to him. He stepped into the water, and she followed. Grabbing a wing strut with one hand, he swung himself onto the nearer pontoon, turned, and extended his other hand to her. Refusing his help, she stepped gracefully onto the pontoon and made her way along the lower wing to the aft cockpit and situated herself there. Jordan untied and retrieved first one anchor, then the other, and quickly seated himself in the forward cockpit. He switched on the ignition, double-checked fuel and oil pressure gauges, and started the large radial engine. The propeller rotated feebly for a few seconds, then the engine coughed, grumbled, and came to life. Jordan cut the float rudders to starboard, bringing the airplane around, facing it into the light northeast wind. He nudged the throttle forward, and the aircraft began to accelerate, bumping across the low ripples on the lake on a bearing that took it gradually away from shore toward the farther side of the narrow lake. As the airplane passed the camp, Jordan glanced to his right and saw that Dr. Cole and his guests had come out onto the deck. They watched the airplane reach the far side of the lake where it had first touched down and thought they saw a passenger in the cockpit behind the island, the pilot, but couldn't make out who it was. Without breaking speed, the pilot brought the airplane around to starboard again, carving a tight turn into the northeast, heading it directly into the wind, then pushed the throttle ahead another notch, accelerating as it came out of the turn. At about 40 knots, the airplane squarely hit the step, the gathering surge of water just ahead of the pontoons. As the nose of the airplane rose, the pilot pulled back on the control yoke and pushed the throttle all the way forward. For a few seconds, the airplane fought the water, working its way up and over the step until it leveled off, and then it was airborne and climbing. From the deck of the camp, Dr. Cole and his wife and their friends watched the airplane rise off the surface of the lake and soar overhead and disappear into the night sky behind them. And when they turned to go back inside and get dressed for dinner, they realized almost as one that the artist passenger was Dr. Cole's daughter, Vanessa. No one said it aloud until the couples were in their respective bedrooms, Dr. Cole and his wife in the master suite, a large, high-ceilinged bedroom just off the living room with its own fireplace, and the others in the guest quarters, a low structure called the lodge that was attached to the main building by a roofed-over walkway. When husband and wife said to each other, "Well, that was fast," and "I don't know where she gets the nerve," and "I didn't even see her leave the room." Dr. Cole pulled on his dinner jacket, brushed his lapels, and shot his cuffs. Checking himself in the mirror, he straightened his bow tie and said to his wife, "What do you think? Is she all right?" "No, of course not. When has Vanessa ever been all right, Carter?" The doctor sat down heavily on the bed and placed his right hand over the left side of his chest and winced. His face had gone pale, and he was sweating. "What's wrong?" his wife said. "Nothing." "You don't look right." "I'm fine, damn it. Leave me alone. It's just..." He grabbed his left arm high up. "No, you're not fine. Are you in pain?" She came over to him and put her hands on his shoulders and stared at him. It's just indigestion. Heartburn is all. "Leave me alone," he said, and shook her off him. "Jesus Christ," he muttered through gritted teeth. "I'm a doctor. I know when something's wrong." I'll stop there. A leap sort of in the air. Okay, I'm sorry I can't read more, but that I have to leave you in the lurch, as it were, because there are other characters and in much event, but you get a clue, at least, of the world and a sense of Vanessa, perhaps, and a sense of Jordan Groves, and then there are two other major characters who come to play. And then it goes on from there. And it's kind of a noir, a wilderness noir, if that's possible, novel, where the femme fatale appears at the beginning, that beautiful, dark woman who... seems to have many needs and a great deal of confusion, and then a well-intended custodial male arrives in her life, or she arrives in his, and before long, complications arise. Thank you all very much.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Carlene Bryce, Rick Steves, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on February 12th, 2008.